This is Money Moves on VSiN, the Sports Betting Network.
Second hour coming up in 15 minutes. Greg Hoops Peterson, host of the Coast to Coast Hoop podcast, is going to join us, VSiN contributor. Take a look at what happened over the weekend in college basketball and look ahead. Had some interesting results, but more importantly, this is pretty much the time when college hoops takes a little bit of the stage away from the National Football League, as we are down, of course, to the Final 14 in the National Football League. But before we get to college basketball, the NFL regular season is in the books. The awards now, all of the data points are set. They do not add. Voting starts now. What you do coming up matters not for what is going to transpire for the awards ballots that these voters are now going to submit. So let's get this out of the way. Yesterday, a ridiculous affair, and I mentioned this to Chris Massaro, who has a very strong feeling about Drake May to win this award for MVP. The awards markets, they don't know really what's going on here at this point. They don't know anything about as to where these voters are going and what's going to happen. And so yesterday is a prime example of how ridiculous these awards markets can be, both the prediction markets and, of course, the odds to win it. Yesterday, when you go into Sunday with the belief, if the betting market is accurate, which, again, I don't want to hear this. Nobody should point to the betting market as evidence to their case that a guy is going to win an award. It has no clue. Nothing transpired yesterday that would cause Drake May to go from a heavy odds on favor to an underdog in this race to win MVP. Nothing at all that transpired. So I'm kind of done with the MVP. And mercifully, I'm ready for this to be over. And yesterday, after Stafford's performance, sure, was there some running up of the score to try to get him numbers? Yes, that's exactly what Drake May and the Patriots did against the Jets. And, of course, the politicking began as well. Here's Sean McVay after the game talk about his guy, Matt Stafford.
And to answer your question, Sarah, yes, I think Matthew's the MVP of the league. He played that way, wouldn't want anybody else leading the way. Got a lot of respect for a bunch of people in this league, but there's nobody I'd rather have being the quarterback of the L.A. Rams than Matthew Stafford. His play speaks for itself.
It does. It does. We'll see if he wins. I'm kind of tired of talking about this. So let's move on. Let's hit some of these awards now. When you look at the status of these awards in terms of odds on favorites. So you have Matthew Stafford to win MVP, minus 180 favorite. Tedrick McMillan, Offensive Rookie of the Year, minus 1,000. These are about an hour old or so. Carson Schwesinger, minus 550 to win Defensive Rookie of the Year. All odds courtesy of DraftKings. Offensive Player of the Year, Jackson Smith and Jigba, minus 3,000. Myles Garrett, minus 20,000 to win Defensive Player of the Year. Coach of the Year, Mike Vrabel at about minus 400. And Comeback Player of the Year, Christian McCaffrey at minus 700. So I think where you start, because this is my question, which of these awards favorites is the weakest? You could go by pure odds and you could just say it's Mike Vrabel at minus 400 because that is the dude who has the least amount of probability to win his respective award. I don't really think that's the case. Again, I don't believe that these awards markets are entirely accurate. I would agree with guys like Massaro who believe that Vrabel's going to win this. I do think that a lot of voters are going to look at Vrabel, the preseason expectations. Again, a lot of us in betting circles think that what we view as preseason expectations are the truth. I'll steal a line from Gil Alexander, which is, we are too close to the sun. So we believe that the preseason expectations are the win total. And then thus, that belief is expanded out to everybody who's deciding this award. I don't think that's the case. I think a lot of people are going to look at the Patriots from last year and then the Patriots from this year and look at Mike Vrabel and say, yeah, he should probably win this award. So I think that you could make the argument Vrabel, even at minus 400, maybe should be a little bit higher. Again, trying to get into the minds of some of these voters and the simple aspect with which they operate. I think the most interesting one is the award markets for the two rookie categories. Offensive Rookie of the Year, let's start here. Tedrick McMillan at minus 1,000. What I don't understand are twofold. First off, I don't understand the number. I think Tedrick McMillan has had a very strong year for a rookie. I don't understand why people believe he is just going to win this outside of just looking at these odds and saying, yeah, of course, he's got to be it. We run with the premise, again, that these are accurate, which I don't think is the case. And what I think is most interesting about this is, first off, similar to the dynamic of Matthew Stafford versus Drake May, I don't know why you watched yesterday and thought, you know what, Tyler Shuck, who was maybe going to be the favorite to win this thing, now all of a sudden you're 15-1. And Jackson Dart, you have better odds to win this thing all of a sudden. When Jackson Dart heading into the game yesterday, still had better numbers than Tyler Shuck, mostly because he played more games, but in terms of total touchdowns and yards. So I thought it was interesting to compare here for the two. I do think the market does have this right. Dart, I think, has a better shot to win this than Shuck. I think he's had a better chance to win Offensive Rookie of the Year this entire time. If you look at the passing yards, Shuck does have the advantage in fewer games at 2,300 to about 2,384 to 2,272 in terms of total passing yards. But passing touchdowns, Dart has the edge, 15 to 10. Fewer interceptions, 5 to 6. The edge goes to Dart. Tyler Shuck has a higher completion percentage, but if you look at rushing yards and rushing touchdowns, there's no comparison. Dart gets it done. His last performance, one of the better ones, as we looked at yesterday against the Dallas Cowboys. And I think bigger picture, as we kind of linger on Dart here, I do think that Dart is still live. We didn't have time to bring this up with Stormy. She's got this 21-1 ticket on him to an Offensive Rookie of the Year. And it's just as simple as, again, I think voters are pretty simple-minded when it comes to some of these things. There are some voters who are going to look at expected points added and completion percentage over expected composite. There's going to be a lot of those voters. But there's also going to be a lot of voters who are going to look at the quarterback for the New York Giants, who had in totality 24 touchdowns and 5 interceptions, and say, you know what? I think that guy should win the award. And Tenoroa McMillan, with a strong year for a team that had a losing record, yeah, I mean, there's probably something there for him after a very strong campaign in which for the Carolina Panthers, he had 70 receptions, just over 1,000 yards, and 7 touchdowns. But I don't think that he has had this campaign to the point where he should be laying this price. He ends the year on a strong note in a primetime spot with a really big game in a must-win scenario that they end up losing. He's not going to get dinged for losing the game. But if you take the entirety of his work, I don't think he has this massive edge over these guys that we're talking about. And by the way, again, to the point of these awards odds, Travion Henderson, I mean, I guess after yesterday, you're back up to 9-1, but you are just throwing darts at a board when you're trying to keep these odds up during these games and guessing as to what's going to happen with them. So all in all, as you look at this awards market, I do think McMillan's pretty weak at minus 1,000, and I think that even now at 9-1 would be worth adding Jackson Dart here to win this award. The other one that I think is going to be really interesting is Defensive Rookie of the Year. Now, obviously, the two Rookie of the Year markets are, I think, the ones that are more malleable. They're more volatile. It is hard to evaluate rookies in general. I think when you talk about these awards, we know that there is no tie to performance in that winning doesn't really matter as much. Defensive Player of the Year, I think, is the same thing. Schlesinger becomes an interesting case because if you go back to Christmas Eve when Pelissero releases the report that he talked to GMs and executives, in that poll that he had, Schlesinger swept. He had every first place vote. James Pierce Jr. behind him, of course. Pierce Jr. plays yesterday, and Carson Schlesinger does not. So that might be something that, again, dings him when you're talking about evaluating what's happening, just having one fewer data point. And James Pierce Jr. ends the year pretty strong against the New Orleans Saints. Has 3 total tackles, 2 of them solo. Ends up in the game with 2 sacks as well, 2 tackles for loss. Has a really strong showing there. Has the sexy numbers, too. When you look at James Pierce Jr., sexy numbers, of course, being sacks. Finishes with 10.5 on the year. No other big plays. Did force a fumble and didn't pick anything off. Schlesinger is a tackle machine for a defense that had been playing very, very well throughout the entirety of the year. By PFF standards, he's the 4th highest graded defender in the NFL. By, rookie defender, I should say. Carson Schlesinger, that is. I still think he probably wins this award, but there's going to be a lot of voters who would look at Schlesinger and just see interior linebacker eating up tackles and look at 10.5 sacks for a rookie edge rusher like James Pierce Jr. and gravitate towards that. So I can understand this race where it's at right now. And Nick Emmanuel, as much as I think that he has been absolutely great for the Seattle Seahawks, I don't think there's any voter that is evaluating a box safety to the point where they understand his importance and the fact that he could win this thing. I don't think it's any slight on him. I just think it's a fact that voters who have these ballots can't do the due diligence to accurately evaluate these players. So they're just going to gravitate towards some of the simplest statistics and take a really big view of it as opposed to looking week to week. And I told this to Will Hill yesterday. I was on his Should Have Bet More podcast, part of the VSiN podcast family now. Go check that out wherever you get your podcasts. We view this, I think, as bettors week to week. Okay, this guy did this week. This guy did this week. I don't think that there's a single voter that goes out there and every single week has a giant whiteboard and has their guys ranked every single week and after every single performance moves guys around on the whiteboard. That's not how this works. And so we view it that way because the odds get updated every single week. But I think a lot of voters, and some have been on the record as saying, they don't even look at this stuff until the season ends. So I do think there's a chance that with a 1,000-foot view, Carson Schwessinger is a little bit more fragile at minus 550, if you will, to win this award than what you would think. And if you're in a position like me, or I know some others at the network, you'd be taking a piece of James Pierce Jr. And I do think that's probably the two guys you're down to here. But it is at least somewhat heartening to know that the poll prior did have Schwessinger on the minds of a lot of people when it came to the decision-making for the votes. Outside of that, it's hard to really make a case against anybody else for some of these awards. Jackson Smith-Njigba at minus 3,000. Maybe you quibble with that price because it's going to be a little bit tighter. Puka Nacua has had a very strong year, but a glut of his performance, his numbers have come at the back end of the year. It's a season-long award. Does he get credit for a massive stretch to end the year, or does Jackson Smith-Njigba get to run away with this thing because he's been more consistent over the course of a large sample size? Then you have the two guys there. And then Christian McCaffrey at minus 700 to win comeback player of the year. He's also 75-1 to win offensive player of the year. Comeback seems like one that's really hard to gauge. At least we're done with the Phillip Rivers nonsense that people were trying to make the case for. We know that Daniel Jones, obviously, he's not going to win this either and knew he wasn't going to prior to it. But I will say, Trevor Lawrence and the way he pushed at the end of the year, we went over some of his numbers earlier. We can go over them again a little bit later before we get out of here. At 5-1, considering the way he played and the way that the Jaguars ended the season with that seed, again, a lot of these voters are going to be swinging in from just at the end of the season. They haven't been tracking this week to week. Lawrence might have a better shot at winning comeback player of the year than I think we give him credit for. Remember, he only played 10 games a season ago. All right, let's take a reprieve from football. On the other side, Greg Peterson's going to be with us. We get his best bets for tonight. Take a look at what happened this last weekend. See if we can take anything away. And maybe there's some futures to add as you, I, and everybody else are starting to finally focus on college hoops. So you're listening to this podcast because you want an edge. But what if I told you you're only halfway there? You've got the mindset. Now it's time to get the toolkit to match. Here's the thing. Pro bettors spend thousands on data and tools. But what they don't want you to know is that you can get the same edge for a fraction of the cost with VSiN Pro. VSiN Pro gives you access to expert picks, public betting data, prop projections, powerful tools, analytics, and more. Just tap the link in the description and see why thousands of bettors are already using VSiN Pro to cash more bets.
You're watching Money Moves here on VSiN, the Sports Betting Network.
There's no better partner for football than the flavor you get from Omaha Steaks, the official sponsor of tailgating. And right now, if you spend $129, you can score 2 pounds of fully cooked chicken wings plus 50% off site-wide at omahasteaks.com/VSiN. Don't wait. Spend $129. Get 2 pounds of wings, 50% off site-wide on steaks and more. Half off. That's crazy. Go to omahasteaks.com/VSIN. That's omahasteaks.com/VSIN. Minimum purchase required. See site for details. Welcome back into Money Moves. Last 45 minutes, we've got a lot to jam into over the course of the next three segments. So let's get right to it and head out to the Progressive Guest Line. It was a busy weekend. We had a lot of football. The wild card weekend is set, but we had college basketball as well, and conference play is underway. In the early goings, we've had some big boys get pushed to the limit. No better person to break it down with than one Greg Peterson, who joins us on the Progressive Guest Line. Greg, we appreciate it. We'll get to some of your best bets, which, by the way, people can find in two spots, VSiN.com, and, of course, Coast to Coast Hoops podcast. But let's start with some of the big-ranked teams that we saw in action over the weekend. Specifically, want to start in the ACC. I don't know what we're seeing from Duke here. Maybe you can tell me a little bit more. We watched them at home against Georgia Tech, getting a little bit of a scrap, end up pulling away 85-79. And then over the weekend on the road against Florida State, they barely get by the Seminoles 91-87. They've got a fascinating road trip coming up tomorrow against Louisville. Should we be worried about the Blue Devils in the big picture after watching them scrap around in the ACC?
I would say a little bit, mainly because it feels like with Duke, the kryptonite of this team is turnovers. When they've had turnover issues, even go back to that game against Lipscomb. I recognize that they won that game against Lipscomb by 20-plus points, but they were trailing for about the first 12 or so minutes of that game because they were sloppy with the ball. And Cameron Boozer is amazing. He's right now the top player with regards to Wooden Award odds, but because they're running so much through Cam Boozer, they don't have as much of a true point guard. I think that they need Caleb Foster, Isaiah Evans, one of those guys to be able to step up, give a little bit more facilitation in the backcourt. And that's really what I've been seeing out of Duke, because you've got so much size around the perimeter. This is still one of the top defenses in all of college basketball, and I feel like that's a little bit of a misnomer. with Duke. When you think Duke, you think of just so many great offensive players, what have you. Ever since John Shire has gotten there, they're a little bit of a lower tempo team. They're a little bit more based around defense, but I think the big issue for this Duke team is going to be the turnovers. Now, the good news is for them, they're not going to have to face off against Mikel Brown of Louisville on Tuesday. Looks like he's already been ruled out, but this is a Louisville team that has some active hands, and that could put them on upset alert.
All right, and the other game, or the other big team, I should say, somewhat uncharacteristic of watching Houston recently as well. What have we made of what the Cougars are doing here in terms of their own struggles, specifically most recently, just barely getting by, a team like Cincinnati. I think it was 67-60 over the weekend.
It feels like the depth down low hasn't been there with Houston the way that it has been in past years. Chris Seneca has been very good as a freshman, 7-plus rebounds per game. You return Joseph Tugler, but the one thing that they did lose from the title team from a season ago is a lot of that forward depth, and we've been seeing that quite a bit. They've been pushed around a little bit more down low, and on top of that, Milo Zuzan, currently shooting less than 30% from three-point range this year. Now, he did have a nice game against Cincinnati, and that's an encouraging sign for Houston, because I do think that with Houston, even though they've had Kingston Flemings step up, become really that top scorer out there in the backcourt along with Emmanuel Sharp, you are going to need Milo Zuzan to do a little bit more of what he did a season ago. He's been a little bit silent. We'll see if that gets them going. But for Houston, it did feel like in that second half against Cincinnati, because they were trailing for quite a bit of that first half, it felt like they got back to their roots. Feels like Houston got away from what they were doing a little bit more, getting Zuzan involved, being able to get back to playing super slow, super controlled, I think is going to be big for Houston, but I need to see it in their next game as well, because I've been a little bit disappointed by this team myself. I thought that they were going to be perhaps the biggest challenger to the likes of Iowa State, Arizona coming into Big 12 conference play, and that game against Cincinnati, even though they got the job done, a little bit discouraging.
All right, let's take one more big picture view here, because I know you got an interesting name for the Wooden Award, because over the weekend we saw again A.J. Devansa have a very good performance on the road against K-State. 24 points, grabbed 8 rebounds, 3 assists, hit about 53% of his shots. He is the nation's leading scorer and shooting 58% from the floor. He's behind Boozer, who is the odds-on favorite, as you mentioned. Are we looking at Devansa, or is there somebody else maybe on this Wooden Award market that is worth grabbing at a longer price?
A.J. Devansa has been having himself a really nice year, but I do think that this Wooden Award could be coming down to which team wins the Big 12. And right now, for Iowa State, Joshua Jefferson has been doing it all. Like, this guy stands 6'7", 6'8". He gives you 5 assists, multiple steals, shoots 40% from 3. He's been the top scorer for Iowa State, and Iowa State was without their main guard in Tamon Lipsby for 3 or 4 games. He was the guy that was able to stabilize them. And I do think that it's going to be a little bit dependent upon them being able to win this conference. But as we know, Iowa State has not lost a game this year. Their biggest competition when they went up against Purdue on the road, they won that game by 20-plus points. I think that Joshua Jefferson, I've been seeing him mostly right around about 30-1, even some 40-1s. I think that he's got a little bit of value. Does Devansa right now have a little bit of a better chance than Jefferson as of right now on this day to win the award? Absolutely. But if you're looking at the value and the value itself, I really do think that it's on Jefferson, because I think that he could be the main guy for an Iowa State team. I think has a very good chance to win this Big 12.
Joshua Jefferson, graduate of Liberty High School out here in Henderson. So good job. Like the pick. Greg Peterson with us at GUnit_81. Again, Coast to Coast Hoops, where you want to get the podcast is, as we keep saying here this week, Greg, this is now time to really focus for a lot of people on college basketball. So we got a short slate today. Let's talk about some of the more interesting ones with some brand names. Let's start with Nebraska, Ohio State. Buckeyes right now, we saw a little bit of a line move. Some spots had Nebraska open as a 1-point favorite. It is the Buckeyes now laying 3 with a total of 156.
Yep, and with this one, I'm going to be looking at the under, because both of these teams have been really good at guarding the perimeter. And Nebraska actually dares you to shoot it from three-point range. If you look at Nebraska's home and road and neutral court games, they allow opponents to take 58% of their field goal attempts from three-point range. So they're looking to push things to the outside. You've got an Ohio State team that's allowing teams to shoot less than 30% from three-point range as well. I think that that leads to an under. You don't have either team really playing at a super-duper fast pace. Both of these teams are right around about 150th in the case of Ohio State in terms of possessions per game. Nebraska more around about 190th. And for Nebraska, they do a nice job not allowing a lot of second and third chances. Ohio State, not a team that grabs a lot of offensive rebounds themselves, but they don't allow you to grab a lot of offensive rebounds. So you're going to get a lot of one-and-done possessions, and Nebraska just keeps getting doubted at every single turn. Now, when they were a favorite, I couldn't get with them. If you're able to get like a 2.5, a 3, that does become my buy point on Nebraska. Wouldn't necessarily want the money line, but this Nebraska team still undefeated. Have an Ohio State team that's been a little bit shaky down low. So I'm willing to take 3+ here with Nebraska, but I really like that under with the way that both of these teams guard the perimeter.
Now, there are some power conferences and power teams in action. We could talk about Oregon Rutgers. We can talk about USC Michigan State. We'll get to those. But I think you might know where I'm going with this, Greg, because I'm a fan of tracking certain programs, especially once their coaches decide that radio is a little too much for them and maybe they should focus on the task at hand. And I am also somebody that admits when presented with new information that maybe he was wrong. Doug Gottlieb, I believe, is 2-1 as head coach since quitting the radio show. They get Milwaukee here today. They're 2.5-point dogs at home. Totals 144.5 at open, 149.5. Are the Phoenix live? Will they rise from the ashes now that their coach is focusing on what he should be, which is basketball?
They have been playing much better recently. Last year, this thing was absolutely atrocious with them. I did set my line at 2.5, so I'm going to be waiting on a little bit of movement. I was seeing Milwaukee a little bit earlier as like a 2, 1.5-point favorite. If we could get back to like a 2, I'd be willing to lay with Milwaukee. Big time rivalry out there in the great state of Wisconsin, someplace that I'm from, so I know all about this. But I do look at this total going down to a 144.5. I do like the over. UW Green Bay forces no turnovers whatsoever. They are outside the top 355 in terms of turnovers per possession, and there's 365 Division I teams, so bottom 10 mark. They really don't give themselves a lot of second and third chances, and UW-Milwaukee takes care of the ball. Fewer than 10 turnovers per game. They themselves not going to generate a lot of turnovers, and UW-Milwaukee awful at guarding the three-point line outside the top 325 in all of college basketball. Green Bay, slower team outside the top 300 in terms of total possessions per game, but I think you get good efficiency. And with this line being at 2.5, if it's close, you know what that means, late game fouling. So right now with Milwaukee, if I could get them at a 2 or less, I'd be willing to lay it, but I really do like that 144.5 to the over.
All right, let's get you out of here on this Big Ten matchup, USC-Michigan State. No shame, I think, in getting smashed by Michigan. Pretty much everybody's doing it nowadays. USC hits the road to take on Michigan State here. They're catching 10.5 with a total of 150.5. Can the Trojans bounce back, or will the Spartans get this done as a double-digit favorite?
Anything of double figures was a buy point for me on USC. I saw an 11 overnight, and I took that personally. Right now, we're seeing more 10.5. I'd be willing to take a shot. Now, USC is dealing with a little bit of injury, and I think that that's going to cause them to slow down, especially against a Michigan State team that has been rock solid on defense. Michigan State 29th in terms of points allowed on a per-possession basis. Top five team in terms of rebound percentage. Dealing with that Rodney Rice injury does hurt USC, but they've actually been strong down low, and the forte of USC getting to the free throw line, a top 10 team in terms of free throw attempts on a per possession basis. I think that that's going to be just enough for them to stay lively in a game that I think gets slowed down a little bit more by a Michigan State team that's shut down pretty much everyone not named Cornell. So I'm going to be in on that under, and 10+, that's my buy point on USC.
You can find all the work for Greg, VSiN.com, Coast to Coast Hoops, Betting Pod, and more. Greg, appreciate it, sir. We'll talk again soon. Good luck tonight.
Always great to be on you, JVT. Thank you.
Got it at GUnit_81. We come back. Somebody who was here at the desk with me yesterday during Live Bet Sunday, Dustin Sweetelson, host of Cashin' Out, join us. Get his thoughts on the college football playoff semifinals and the NFL wildcard weekend as well.
You're watching Money Moves here on VSiN, the Sports Betting Network.
ProfitX, the number one sports prediction market, has become the best future pricing you'll find on college football national championship and Super Bowl odds. With a huge holiday slate shaping playoff seeding, now's the perfect time to get in and take advantage of ProfitX 20% purchase match. Download ProfitX today and experience the future of winning. Use promo code VSIN, that's V-S-I-N, to get started. Last 30 minutes, Jonathan Von Tobel. I am flying solo today, but if we could, I know we have Dustin Sweetelson here. Dustin cashes a bet before we even get started. I texted Stormy Bonatoni. She was with us earlier, had some connectivity issues, so we had to put her on phone. And the board that we used with her photo had thrown me off a little bit because it just looked different. So I did send this picture to her, and I asked her, I said, why does this photo look so different? Why is this throwing me off? And Dustin, you nailed it. She said that that was a VGK photo shoot right after she got hired in 2019. He joins us here on the Progressive Guest Line. You can see the picture there, but congratulations. I don't know why it threw me off. It's not the person I sit next to almost every single day, and sure enough, it's a 6-7-year-old picture.
The vibes of this picture of one Stormy Bonantoni, it screams LinkedIn profile, but I don't want it to look like a headshot. I want it to look professional but casual, like I was caught in the moment. So I think it was all, like, purposeful. Like, they intended for it to be the use of it. But that was just the vibes I got. It was a work headshot that was meant to not look like an actual headshot, like you go to JCPenney and get done.
She shamed me into changing my LinkedIn profile picture because it was just like me with a shaved head. And she's like, you don't look like that anymore. You look like a psychopath. You got to change the picture. And I was like, oh, okay, I guess. Yeah.
I mean, did you just call everyone with a shaved head a psychopath?
No, she did, actually. I think that we all look like great people when we shave our heads. So thank you very much. All right, Dustin Sweetelson with us. He was with me on the desk yesterday. Quite a fun day. I was talking to some folks outside of the studio today, and one of them made the comment, you know, I wanted to ask Jeff Benson to take Packers-Vikings off the screen out in the book. And I said, what are you talking about? That was the only game I was watching yesterday. So very much looking forward to some real playoff football. Let's start in the NFL, though, Dustin, because we have our line set as we look ahead. Let's start with I know you have a couple, but let's go wherever you want to go. When you looked at the wild card board, what was the first thing that stuck out to you?
I mean, I hate to be a Drake May hater here and continue this theme, but there was two lines that said the books are baiting you to take the 3.5. It was San Francisco and the 3.5 at Philly, which I couldn't quite get there on, at least yet. And then the Chargers plus 3.5. And I've said all along, I was going to back the Chargers if they went to Foxborough. I just think defense travels, and that defense is playing at a high level. 9th in scoring, 20 points per game, 5th against the pass, 8th against the run. Defense will show up, and it'll actually be a team above 500 that Drake May is going to have to face with a lot on the line here. Harbaugh's really good in the underdog role too. He thrives in this. And what he's doing with Justin Herbert this season for the most part is they're limiting possessions. They are making it low scoring games and looking for Herbert in the fourth quarter to make a couple of big throws to win you the game. They don't want it to be an up and down track meet. If they can condense this game with their defense, I think the Chargers are live, not just to cover. I think they could win this game. Harbaugh 6-3 covering the number as a dog with the Chargers, 15-9 in his career, 4-2 against the spread as a road dog with the Chargers. Mike Vrabel 2-3 against the spread in the playoffs in his career. Give me Harbaugh. Give me the Chargers. I think they have a chance to advance.
All right, let's talk about the Los Angeles Rams, not from the MVP standpoint. I'm with you. I'm done. Our data points are set. It's all to the voters now. There's no need to debate anymore. There's no need for disingenuous arguments and weird conversations about one-yard touchdown passes. We're good. So now they get to go on the road again, take on the Carolina Panthers. I mean, I'll resist. I'm trying hard to resist a sarcastic.
Common opponents, you know, though, JVT. How'd they do against the common opponents, not the other elite teams that were faced by one of the candidates, not the other?
This is not a pro Stafford statement I'm about to make. But, folks, it's not easy to throw touchdowns in the red zone. I just want to send that out there, okay? Just want to put that out there. Anyway. They're back in Carolina, one of the sites of their most embarrassing performances. Atlanta, also one of those. What do you make of what they have here? Do we go side? Do we go total? Do we go somewhere else for the Rams?
All right, I'm going to go team total, but I did consider Carolina in the points. I know Money Moves is a big Panther show. I know you guys have been on the Panthers a lot. This is the recipe where you do think about the Panthers. 9-5 against the spread at home, 5-2 covering the number as home dogs. They score, you know, 4 more points, almost 5 more points per game at home versus the road. The problem is what you have with the Rams coming to town is that you're not sneaking up on them this time. They know exactly what you want to do to knock them off. So it's going to be difficult. And I'm concerned about this Rams defense. I think this Rams defense has some leaks the last couple weeks. I don't know if you watched that game with Arizona yesterday, but Jacoby Brissett was throwing some hospital ball bombs that were getting completed downfield to Michael Wilson. Rams defense allowing 29.75 points per game the last four weeks, sixth worst scoring defense the last 3 weeks. Listen to who they're behind. Dallas, Arizona, Miami, the Jets, and Indy. So the only teams worse than them defensively in terms of scoring the last 3 weeks are some of the worst in football. I think that can lead to some extra possessions for the Rams offense, similar to the Cardinals yesterday, where they're going to have to keep punching. And this Rams offense, Sean McVay alluded to this after the Seattle game, they've got to get in sync. They've got to stay in a rhythm, and I think you don't call off the dogs if you're up by a lot. That's why I like Rams team total over 28.5. McVay on the full game, 4-2 to the over when he plays on Saturdays. Take that for what it's worth. But that was the only supporting trend I had for my argument here. I just think the Rams offense needs to stay crisp, and they put about 30-31 on the Carolina Panthers.
Something about those Saturdays. Very strong for Sean McVay. Dustin Sweetelson with us. Follow him up on X at Dustin Sweetelson, cashing out host as well. All right, let's talk about Chicago and Green Bay. Really interesting game. Bears kind of go limping into the postseason. So, too, you could argue the Green Bay Packers, especially because of a lot of the injuries here. Green Bay, yeah, this is floating around like a money line price of a pick, you know, depending on where you're looking, the juiced side in terms of the total or in terms of the spread as well. So what do we do with a game like this between two teams that aren't in the best form heading into the wild card?
I think you got to look to the over. You got to look to the over, especially with Chicago, this game being played at Soldier Field. They'll be able to dictate the pace, the style of this fight. And the Packers are missing two of their best defensive players. No Devontae Wyatt on the D-line, no Micah Parsons. Last 4 weeks for them, which includes against Minnesota yesterday, where they allowed 16 points, they're allowing 26.25 points per game. Okay? This defense has taken major steps back. The Chicago defense is not good either. Last three games, they're allowing 25.7. Ben Johnson always seems to have crazy stuff in his back pocket when he needs it. Feels like in this scenario in the postseason, he's going to be deep in his bag, wanting to pick up a win for the Chicago Bears in the postseason. And then the trends on Matt LaFleur, I found a lot that lead me to the over. I like over 46 in Packers Bears. 34-26 to the over. Matt LaFleur is on the road. 21-13 to the over when the total's between 42.5 and 49. He's 10-6 to the over in January. I think we're going to see a lot of points because I don't think this Bears defense is going to limit Green Bay's offense very much, especially if they get the ground game going. And then on the other side, the Bears just have a variety of ways that they can attack this Green Bay defense without Micah Parsons and Wyatt there to clog the middle.
All right. I asked this question to our audience, and I'll ask this to you. Is the Texans defense versus the Steelers offense the biggest mismatch in terms of two units this weekend?
Ooh. Yeah, it's the biggest mismatch, right? And then the biggest strength on strength is probably the Niners and the Eagles, right? To go opposite you there.
It's probably one of those, yeah.
Yeah, but this is definitely the biggest, and that's why I like the under. I need someone to make me a case for how Pittsburgh moves the football here. And by the way, I am so happy that the Steelers put me out of my misery with my Baltimore Ravens 22-1 Super Bowl ticket. Like, you knew that thing wasn't going to happen, but they were going to toy with us a little if they made the playoffs. I didn't want to believe. That team stinks. Pittsburgh stinks too. Let's be fair. They're probably the worst 10-win team I've seen in a while. But credit to Mike Tomlin. He finds a way. He does it again. He's not on the hot seat. They can't remove him. But because of what you alluded to with this mismatch, I think this Texas defense just smothers Pittsburgh. They're not going to be able to run the ball. The Texans are fourth versus the run. They're not going to be able to pass the ball. They're sixth versus the pass, third in opponent completion percentage allowed. The Texans defense, number one in defensive EPA per play, second in scoring defense. I don't see how Pittsburgh is scoring touchdowns multiple. They might get one, maybe on that opening scripted drive, but I don't see multiple. I see a lot of field goals here. D'Amico Ryan, 17-6 to the under in his career, 16-10 to the under on the road, 22-13 to the under on grass. Tomlin, 65-50 to the under when he's a dog, 22-13 when he's a home dog. Yeah, give me the under 39.5 all day long.
All right, we like it. Last minute, I know you've got a future position, but just in terms of side or total in the semifinals for the college football playoff, is there a side, if you remove yourself from the equation, you like?
Indiana -4. I got to stop doubting them, man. I had their win total. I bet no other futures on them this year. I did not think they'd be – I thought they'd be really good. I thought they'd make the playoff. I did not think – they are not going to shoot themselves in the foot, and I am terrified. As someone who picked Oregon in the VSiN College Football Playoff Betting Guide – I am very concerned about Dan Lanning, the going forward on fourth down. At some point, does that bite him in the rear against an Indiana team that's older, that's veteran? They got like 25-year-old, 26-year-old grown men there. They're going to capitalize on this moment. I would lay that 3.5 right now with Indiana.
All right, Dustin, we appreciate a couple minutes. Thank you very much. Cashing out, you on tonight or are you going back later this week?
I am on tonight, 11 p.m., 2 a.m. Eastern. So hang out with me tonight on VSiN.
There you go. At Dustin Sweetelson. Appreciate it, buddy. All right, let's take our break. We come back. We'll wrap up here on a great edition, I would say, of Money Moves on a Monday. We'll have a best bets for the wildcard weekend recap and take a look. Yes, it's already time at the top of the NFL draft.
You're watching. Team Money Moves here on VSiN, the Sports Betting Network.
I would argue this is probably, I think we say this a lot, it's kind of the best time of year. I mean, we have everything going on, so we're into the NFL postseason, college football deep into their own postseason right now. We are in the semifinals. Those are coming up. We obviously have basketball, both college and professional, going on, hockey, and the NFL draft season, I think, begins in earnest now. We have the top of the draft set, first 18 selections. We know now that the top pick in the NFL draft will go to, drumroll please, we know, the Las Vegas Raiders will select first in the NFL draft. I love how every article you read about draft order now is the Raiders are on the clock, and yet they'll get additional time when we start the draft. You see the odds here for the first overall pick. 2026 NFL draft, Fernando Mendoza is a $5 favorite to be the first selection out of Indiana. Dante Moore at plus 425. Reuben Bain, the edge rusher out of Miami at 22-1. And then quarterback Trinidad Chambliss checks in at 25-1. I don't know who he is. Which one is he, Wyatt? Are you talking about Trinidad Chambliss? Okay, I've just spoken to on the air. I addressed it out loud. Our producer, Wyatt, who's done a wonderful job, by the way. I didn't mean to snap at you there. 40-1 for Trinidad Chambliss. There's a reason why, by the way. We got news today that came down almost as we were putting this together, which was the fact that Chambliss, it does seem, has an agreement in place with Ole Miss that he would return to the Rebels in 2026 if the NCAA approves his pending waiver for a sixth season of eligibility. This did seem pretty strong even before this news came down for Chambliss. Much like the awards, I think at this point right now for the NFL draft, it is information-based. But I think you do kind of react to these odds to every single big performance that kind of transpires. So at this point, it is pretty safe to say that the first overall pick will come down to Fernando Mendoza or Dante Moore. You see the updated odds there. Thanks, crew, for putting that together really quickly. The first pick is going to come down to the two quarterbacks, Fernando Mendoza or Dante Moore. I do think, and we see this all the time in NFL draft as we lead up closer, there's going to be a ton of information. There's going to be a ton of conflicting reports. There's going to be a ton of smoke. And I would assume that if you like Fernando Mendoza to go with the first overall selection, there's going to be a point where these odds dip a little bit more so you don't have to lay $5 for him to be the first overall pick. I mean, the Raiders just found out yesterday that they have the selection, and we don't know who they want because their general manager, John Spytek, doesn't have a head coach, and he doesn't have an offense coordinator at this point right now. So we don't know exactly what the Raiders are looking for or how that group will evaluate these quarterbacks as they get closer to the draft coming up in, what are we talking about, five months from now. But regardless, actually less than 5 months, time flies. The question I think becomes, do you look anywhere else? I think that when you look at Dante Moore and the way that he can play, you know, if you look at some of the metrics with him and the ability to throw the ball downfield, coupled with the ability to take care of the football, that's going to be something that I think that NFL rooms are going to want, NFL executives are going to want, and I think he's probably going to find his way up the odds in terms of plus 425 maybe being the price that might be the highest. I also think we'll see the odds react to when these two play each other. That's going to be the other part about this when you look at who's going to go with the first overall selection. A few of the mock drafts that are out there right now, no question, it is Fernando Mendoza with these selections overall, and I do think it's interesting because you're already starting to see some of these. How about this from Todd McShay? Dante Moore's agent should call the Raiders to see if he can go number one. And if not, he should return to school rather than risk being drafted by the Jets. Quote, I promise you, no single player in this draft wants to be a New York Jet. End quote. That is from Todd McShay. We'll see if that actually transpires. I think it's easy to say that now, but when you're talking about being drafted, it'll be interesting to see if that's going to be the case. And whether or not the Raiders, it's not unthinkable to believe that maybe the Raiders trade this pick, but I even think the Jets, who remember have 5 first-round picks over the next 2 drafts, could actually pass on a quarterback, and what that means for Dante Moore's status, if we assume that these odds are true, that he's the second overall pick, where ultimately he could fall in this draft, I don't think it would be particularly far. Having said that, a team like Arizona, I think, would be more than willing to allow this to happen. Do the Jets just draft the best need possible outside a quarterback, the best player? Would it be Reuben Bain, who checks in right there at 22-1 to be the first overall pick? Could he be the second overall selection? And I think the other really interesting part about this draft, it is by and large, as we called it earlier in the program, a 2-quarterback draft. We know that those 2 quarterbacks are there. By some accounts, the next quarterback on the board, Ty Simpson, I'm going to be fascinated to see what the number is going to be set at for total quarterbacks in the first round and what you do as a shop how you handle that, because right now it seems solidly capped at two quarterbacks, just given the way that we're looking at this and reading the tea leaves. And for those who don't know, that's been one of my big things. Really love betting the under on total quarterbacks in the first round. In the 8 years that we have had this now in the mainstream, you are 6-2 to the under. Last year, of course, went over. But I have been a ardent truther of betting under every single year. So we'll see if that comes to fruition again this year, which is what the number is at this point, because it's going to be pretty hard to set that number considering how weak this quarterback class is. By some accounts, according to Mel Kiper, for example, his positional big board, the fourth quarterback is John Mateer. And I don't think we're getting that deep in this quarterback class for the first, excuse me, for the first round here. So we'll have more NFL draft coverage, but with this draft order now being set, it's at least worth kind of setting the table for what's going to be a very busy draft season as we are getting through the postseason and inching closer and closer to what this is going to be. All right, with that, let's get to best bets and recap over the weekend what happened and then look ahead to this wild card potentially. First off, what happened on Friday night was losses across the board. How about this? The Denver Nuggets, of course, they, again, without their starters, go out there and they push the Cavs to the brink on Friday night. And then yesterday, you get Aaron Gordon back, you get Christian Brown back. Yeah, you can't handle the Brooklyn Nets. The Friday night plays there, the recap, you have the Nuggets get it done as 12.5-point dogs against the Cavs, laid it there, and then the Grizzlies plus four can't stay inside of the number against the Lakers. Eagles minus four against the Washington Commanders, also not there either. For this week, we'll add a couple. We'll add one thing and then one that's been pending for a while now. Indiana minus four, added that last week as we look ahead to the college football semifinal. And the addition threw in that Packers-Jags teaser. Packers plus 7.5, Jags plus 7.5. I feel like that's pretty strong. Of the wild card sides, that was the first thing that stuck out. I am a little tentative. Again, it is not always the number one deal breaker when you talk about betting, obviously. It never really feels great, though, when you can't find conflicting sides on a single side, and that would be Jacksonville. Talked to a lot of people that do think that Jacksonville is pretty live. I am one of those people that I thought this was going to be Jacksonville, like minus 1.5. And in fact, it is not. And the Buffalo Bills are favored here in that spot against them. So we'll see if that ultimately flips. It's a 1.5-point spread. I don't think it would be the craziest thing in the world that we see Jacksonville go off as a 1.5-point underdog, or to be favored in this game. And I think they probably should be. To reiterate what this team has been able to do here, Trevor Lawrence has been playing some incredible football. And at the very least, I can trust that they're going to stay inside of this number of 7.5 on a teaser leg, I think. Since week 13, Lawrence has been your second best passer by PFF standards with a PFF passing grade of 91.9, 15 touchdowns to one interception, and a turnover-worthy play rate of under 1%. He's averaging 8.3 yards per attempt on an average depth of target of 10.5 yards downfield. If you want to go for some of the advanced metrics, fourth over that span and expected points added and completion percentage over expected composite. Jacksonville since week 13 as well. Fifth in expected points added per play, 15th in success rate, so they could be a little reliant on some of those big plays, but do expect that this is a team that is good enough on offense, the way they've been playing, to stay inside of this number, go after a Bills defense, which has had its weaknesses, most of those coming on the ground, and the flip side of that, too, for Jacksonville, defensively, they have consistently been one of the better defenses in the NFL. This is a very, very good group, and so I think against Josh Allen, who maybe is going to be a little bit more healed up after taking a week off, you're at the very least, as part of a teaser leg, going to feel comfortable asking them to stay inside of 7.5. And the other side of this, teasing up the Green Bay Packers, look, the Chicago Bears do come into this somewhat limping when we're talking about their form as we go into the postseason. A really poor performance offensively against the Detroit Lions this last game in the blow, not the blowout, the well, it's a blowout for their defense, but the poor performance of them defensively against the 49ers. They, of course, lost that game to Green Bay, sandwiched in between a blowout, is what I meant to say, of the Browns, and then a wacky game against the Green Bay Packers in which they somehow get it done. Every metric that you have here paints the picture of an average to below average team that has played above its skis for Chicago. And even with the injuries along the defensive line, and we'll see, Jordan Love is gearing toward playing here for the Green Bay Packers. I would expect that Green Bay, again, you feel pretty comfortable getting them plus 7.5. And the question now becomes, do you improve home field by how much in a postseason for a team, for these teams? And if that is the case, what is it? And are these teams to each other, where are they at from a power rating standpoint? I would argue that Green Bay still rates as the better team. The market is telling you they rate as a slightly better team. And I think Chicago, we might be seeing the timer expire here for the Bears as we enter the postseason. We'll talk a little bit more about the others. Again, I do think we have a what am I missing special in this matchup between the Steelers and the Texans. Again, yesterday, market says Ravens can go off as 4, 4.5-point favorites on the road against the Pittsburgh Steelers. Today, just 3 for the Texans on the road against the Steelers. Some spots are 3.5, but juice to the dog side. Look, I don't like this Texans offense. I think that it has had a lot of issues. Having said that, I think they power rate better than a team like the Baltimore Ravens. And yet here they are with a number that's not close to what Baltimore was laying last night, and it got a win game for the AFC North. Does it for us. Storm will be back tomorrow. Got a lot of great guests on tap, including Anna Burke, the mid-major maestro, as we like to call him. Coming up next, Follow the Money. The guy's got a loaded show reacting to a massive final week in the regular season of the NFL, looking ahead to the postseason. Good luck on all your bets. See you tomorrow here on Money Moves.